As we are just days into the second term of President Obama's second term, we explore this morning the hard-fought closing months of the 2012 presidential campaign. Journalist Michael Hastings is the author of Panic 2012, the sublime and terrifying inside story of Obama's final campaign. Hastings, a BuzzFeed correspondent at large, Rolling Stone contributor, George Polk Award winner, and critically acclaimed New York Times bestselling author of The Operators, presents a on-the-ground, real-time, singular account of how the Obama campaign privately panicked and ultimately recovered after the president's disastrous performance in the first debate with Mitt Romney. It's an e-book, and it's an original portrait of the enormous and intense political operation that is an American presidential campaign. The book is an in-depth post-election account of a crucial campaign that revealed the new outlines of a rapidly changing nation. It's a great pleasure to welcome Michael Hastings to the roundtable this morning. Michael, thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for having me. It's exciting.
Well, it is.
I'm pumped about this book. I'm pretty psyched for it. I want it to be in paper as well, but it's ebook right now on the Kindle and on your Nook and on the iPad. But it's pretty cool.
You know, it is cool because it's still I know we live in a very fast technological age, but this all seems very fresh and new to me still, even though it happened in October. But so here we are. The name of the book is Panic 2012. At what point in the investigation, and you explore this in the book, did you get a sense where the panic began within the Obama campaign? There was a sense of panic. Not
sure.
Concern, but panic.
Right. Oh no, total panic. I think after the Denver debate, look, the Obama campaign is a pretty cocky, confident bunch. After Mitt Romney's 47% video, where he was secretly recorded trashing 47% of the country as parasites, all of the senior leadership in Obama land felt that they had this thing locked up. And then Denver happens, and it's quite a devastating moment. And having covered this the campaign and getting to know these people, to watch them kind of freak out over what they felt was Obama letting them down, and they didn't expect it. They didn't see it coming at all. Everyone was taken totally by surprise. And so there is this actual 10-day stretch where the campaign is panicking and they're losing support. Romney actually gained support, but they're losing support. The kind of advantage they got from the 47% video gets wiped out. They're just trying to hold on and realizing, oh my God, like maybe, we could blow this thing. Then, interestingly enough, what happens is that look, they stabilize, they stop the bleeding, there's this sort of funny thing. The Obama people will say, oh, they like to be pretty cool because obviously Obama's president cool, and they are cool customers. But then they say, well, we knew we were going to win this. We weren't panicking at all. But then you look at the emails you were getting, I'm sure you were getting, we all were getting in our inbox, which are from the Obama campaign, which were saying, oh my God, we're going to lose, we're going to lose, we're going to lose, give us money.
Yeah.
So even though there was, that there was a real panic, and then you had this kind of media-generated panic, we read our copy, listen to our programs, this is going to be a tight race, which the Obama campaign said, oh no, the media-generated panic is false. But then they come through and also try to exploit it by getting us to give money to them. So there's a lot of different dynamics of the panic theme that I tried to explore.
How much the whole thing is fascinating. That's why I love the book, is because the whole thing is just so fascinating. For anyone that's interested in politics and political machinations, this thing is just, it's an incredible story because you have the president who chalks this up to a bad night.
Mm-hmm.
I had a bad night. I'm curious as to your thought on this of how much, because you write about this in detail, of he was really following the advice of his advisors,
mm-hmm.
in most cases. How much of that do you think was ultimately of, if we will all on the same page say that in some way that the performance was a failure, how much of that is on the president individually, and how much of it is on those people around him who gave him poor advice?
I think in a case like this, when you're dealing with you know, a president running for re-election, you know, 75% of it's got to be on the guy himself. I mean, he's been through it before. And no matter, because the team, look, the debate prep team that was assembled, they told him. They said, look, we've done studies. The incumbent president usually loses the first debate. You know, they tried to get him to buckle down, even in the weeks preceding the debate. But here, but listen, but this is the president preparing for a debate, and you know, one, you know, today as we're talking right now, you know, Hillary Clinton's testifying about Benghazi on Capitol Hill, and she just, and one of the most incredible stories in this sort of debate prep process is that after President Obama went to Andrews Air Force Base to receive the four victims, the four American officials who were killed in Benghazi, Libya. After he receives, he gives a speech to the flag drape, cast the whole thing. He then goes to debate prep to prepare for, you know, to prepare to talk to Mitt Romney, which he felt he could do. So you have these sort of distractions that you only have if you're president, you know, that are ongoing. And then he goes to this Las Vegas debate prep camp, which is a complete kind of bad idea, and you know, in the end, he didn't bring it. You know, the one time everybody was expecting him to kind of follow through and knock it out of the park, he didn't do it, and I think it rattled him too, and maybe it gave him that extra spark he needed to maybe he needed the drama himself, maybe he needed to feel a little bit of the panic.
So the group that is in the boiler room, if you will, the group that's in the room watching this all unfold on that stage in Denver, was there a feeling immediately that oh my God, this isn't going well?
Yeah, it was actually, to watch it unfold in real time was amazing. Then to go back and interview, you know, we interviewed for this book. I had two wonderful research reporter assistants working with me, probably about 45. You know, Obama people, we did this quick, you know, it was a quick turnaround. But, you know, we talked to all these people who watched this, and originally they actually did try. The Obama people did try to pretend that they were winning, and that it was fine. And you know, journalists were getting emails that night saying, well, doesn't Mitt Romney look, Jim Lehrer, remember, was the moderator from PBS. Well, doesn't Mitt Romney look testy? And so at the same time, you know, we're all sitting there, journalists, we're all getting these separate emails from our sources saying, don't you think Romney looks testy? And I was like, no, Romney doesn't look testy. It looks like your guy's losing. And they said, oh, well, you guys always say that. I say, no, guys, no, I'm telling you, you know, as a journalist, as a friend, as someone, you know, I've got to know you, this is a serious case where you guys are blowing it. And I think that sunk in at the higher levels, people like Stephanie Cutter, David Axelrod, Jim Messina. You know, Jim Messina, before going out to meet the scrum and spin alley after the debate, literally looks around the room with the guys he's with, just watching, and goes, wow, this is going to really suck. and what he meant by that is,
and it did.
He's about to go out there, you know, in front of hundreds of journalists, both the biggest names and the smallest names, and have to answer the question straight, point blank: why'd you lose? How could you be so horrible? Are you going to they were pretty clear that it was pretty bad. There was an attempt. One of the communications guys at some point during this big conference call tried to say, well, we can spin it as, you know, $1 trillion this or that, and you know, this plan and that. But you know, the reality was they knew it was bad. And then we remember we go into the Big Bird. The other highlight, I mean, we so soon forget, was that Mitt Romney did, you know, attack Big Bird during that debate. So literally the next day, too, this is another kind of wacky thing. The Obama campaign is focus grouping people on their feelings about Big Bird.
Which led to that ad.
Yeah, they realized, oh, we got something here. And they ran with it.
We're talking to Michael Hastings. He is the author of a new ebook. It's fascinating. It's called Panic 2012, The Sublime and Terrifying Inside Story of Obama's Final Campaign. It is from BuzzFeed and Blue Rider Press. We will continue our conversation with Michael Hastings after this short break. Michael Hastings is a BuzzFeed correspondent at large, Rolling Stone contributor, and New York Times bestselling author of The Operators. His new ebook is Panic 2012, the sublime and terrifying inside story of Obama's final campaign. One of the things that you raise, Michael, in the book is the really kind of zooming out and taking a look about the conduct of these campaigns in general, and certainly with your eye on the campaign of the president, and asking the question, is the relationship between the press corps and the campaign a little too cozy? I found that interesting because I've certainly been talking to journalists for now decades who have been complaining that they don't have the access that they used to, that there is such a wall, they can't get near the candidates. So they always talk about the glory days of having the drink at the bar in Manchester, right, New Hampshire, and learning all of this stuff. And you paint a much different picture than that.
Well, ironically, too, what ended up getting me into trouble with, because at one point the White House Press Correspondents Association and the White House and a campaign spokesman, they tried to actually throw me off the campaign plane and bus. They tried to ban me from...
Yeah, and tell us why, because it seems stupid.
But you hit the nail on the head. Well, it is. The stakes are low. The stakes do not get lower than this. I will freely admit to that. But you hit the nail on the head when you said, these other journalists that you spoke to in the past, were reminiscing fondly about the days when they could have a drink with the president or with these guys. And the thing is, we did. So we had a drink with the president. And it was awesome. Everybody went crazy. It was this bar in Orlando, Florida, and it was right after the Democratic National Convention, and Obama comes down among the press, and drops by. There was this secret off-the-record drink session with the senior advisors where Obama shows up as a surprise visitor and hangs out and had a good time. It seemed everybody had a good time. A month later, I just wrote, Obama showed up and had a drink, with the press, and they said, you can't report that because we have to pretend that never happened, that didn't exist. I said, well, that seems a little crazy, and it's also not following the actual policy where you're supposed to report these events. You don't report what was said, but you report the event. But the point I'm trying to make in a little long-winded way is that the reason they were so upset is because they don't get these chances to have a drink with the president, to see the president like this. It becomes so valuable to them and so meaningful that any thought that because of some, jerk from Rolling Stone and BuzzFeed is going to write something that could jeopardize it ever happening again. That's why they flipped out. Because they're like, we need to hold on to every little bit of access we can get. Now, the flip side is, what are they getting with this access, and what does it say that the campaign feels that they, or the White House feels that they have so much control and sway over the journalists that they can get positive coverage just by letting us, hang out with a guy for
right,
a half hour. I think it goes back and forth. I think it's a tough beat in that access is the name of the game, for a lot of these guys, and I had a number of conversations with journalists along the way and they'd say the same thing. Look, there's tons of stuff we know that we can't report because I'll never get the call back again from a source or whatever. And I think that's a real problem. And there's a reason why you don't get great reporting out of the White. I mean, you get competent reporting generally from the White House press corps, and you get really talented guys there like Jake Tapper, Olivia Knox. There's some really talented people there, but you're not winning any Pulitzers, for the most part.
And for you, ultimately, when they were, it ended up being a slap on the wrist because they want to put you in line, but they also don't want to lose that coverage in BuzzFeed and Rolling Stone.
right. They also realized. I think I might have even said this explicitly. I was like, look, you guys can kick me off the plane, but you realize you just gave me three chapters in my book. Look, and I didn't want to be, I actually wasn't even trying to be kicked off was the amazing thing. I was just sort of doing my thing. Yes, no, look, they, and plus, BuzzFeed is it one of the talk about changing media environment. The way these things work, when you cover them, you sign up for they call it the charter plane, the zoo plane, as famously described in Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas and Boys on the campaign trail and Boys on the Bus. These media outlets pay hundreds of thousands of dollars to get a seat on the plane. It costs over $1 million to get a seat on Air Force One for the year. I mean, this is expensive stuff. And now with all the media cuts and everything like that, it's very difficult, you know, to justify this. So you had this funny situation where they start to need people like BuzzFeed and Yahoo. And at the front of the plane now, it was amazing. It was like literally CNN, New York Times, then it was like Yahoo and BuzzFeed, you know, with the Wall Street Journal. And so it's a completely different media environment. And it's been fun to kind of watch that and be a part of it, for sure.
You write about how this actually even became physical with Rahm Emanuel.
Right. Well, yeah, I have a couple of misadventures throughout the book. As I said, there's the kind of classic what it takes, the making of the president narrative, which brings us behind the scenes with these guys in the debate and Benghazi and the hurricane. And then yes, I have my sort of, journeys with George, travels along the, campaign trail. And 2 days after the election in Chicago, I was in Chicago and I was attending as a guest, this really ritzy, high-dollar fundraiser, ironically enough, at the Ritz-Carlton in Chicago, where Mayor Emanuel was giving a speech about essentially how, to get rid of the public education system and just have large corporations give money to public education. It was in front of 500 people. It was videotaped. And me, I was there just, enjoying myself, doing reporting for the book, and I saw him after in the lobby, and I said, Mr. Mayor, Michael Hastings, Rolling Stone, and I have a question for you, if you don't mind. Well, he minded, apparently, and he flipped out and started trashing Rolling Stone, trashing me, and then he did something that I had never had happen to me before from a public official. He grabbed me, and while his bodyguards kind of surrounded me, and this sort of threat of physical intimidation. I was surprised. I was surprised. I did not expect that from any major U.S. official. Look, I've interviewed dictators, terrorists, a lot of violent people, a lot of army people in the military, people who've been through a lot of bad stuff just as it happened. And no one's ever really put their hands on me. And look, there's no whambulance. I'm not going to, I'll my only recourse is to say, well, look, put it on record and say this is the kind of guy this guy is. And he's the kind of guy who's willing to threaten, violence against journalists, which, I'm sure there's a lot of politicians who'd love to threaten violence against journalists.
Yeah, but to actually do it, right?
Yeah, but so, there's a line. Once they lay their hands on you, there's kind of a line.
So we just have a few minutes, but there's a couple things I want to clear up. But one of them being, so how much do you think was that an individual act by Rahm Emanuel, and how much of it was a mirror of the thought from the campaign about you, a concern by the campaign about you and what you would write?
Oh, I think in this case, it was about me and Rolling Stone in terms of the nature of his response. But I think it was about him. It was and I think it makes this larger point about, the Democratic Party and a guy like, Mayor Emanuel, who's, basically center-right kind of corporatist Democrat, about power. He's all about power, and that's how he gets away with this. This wasn't the first time. I mean, in fact, the next day a Chicago columnist wrote a column saying there should be a support group for people who've been bullied by Rahm Emanuel. and he went through, and he's been doing this for years, and he gets away with it. And because he's been successful at coercing people and raising money, and he raised millions of dollars at the last during the last months for the Obama super PAC after he'd left his job on the Obama campaign, which is a clear violation of the spirit of campaign finance. But anyway, I think it was that.
But the two things that I find interesting about that, and wrapping up, the two things I find interesting are, one, I mean, if Rolling Stone isn't going to be your friend, who, as a Democratic candidate and party, and two, when you look at this book, I mean, it isn't a trash job. I mean, you certainly paint them, you tell these stories, you paint, and certainly people are put in a bad light. But I think it's overall, very real and understanding portrait of the campaign.
Yeah, I probably treated him too nicely, I think, on the campaign.
Yeah, I think so. The campaign comes out looking pretty good in this book.
Yeah, and you know, the thing is, I told them that. Look, I said, you know, look, I'm getting people to open up for me, and these people, their careers are on the line, you know, how they're portrayed in these things. It's very important. And I'm always very straight up. I said, look, you know, you guys won. So how bad can the story be if you want? You know.
Well, there's that.
Yeah, you know, that was my pitch, and I think, yeah, as you said with Mayor Emanuel, I think it's a personality thing. I think, look, Rolling Stone obviously has been a huge supporter of President Obama. I mean, they put him on the cover, you know, four or five times. And one of the things Rahm was mad about was this last Rolling Stone cover. And it's like, what are you talking about? So I think that was just kind of an independent thing, but it was also, you know, the nature of power. You know what happens, and I'm sure we'll see this with the Obama campaign as well, a second term. I mean, these guys have become accustomed to being very, very powerful, and that makes it even more difficult, I think, to keep a check on them, like we're supposed to do, and the White House reporters will say this. They're like, they were like, you know, at certain points, this is horrible, but at certain points, literally, you know, as members of the press corps, whenever we'd have, you know, run-ins with the White House staff, we'd be like, on the one hand, man, we'd love to see these guys lose just to have them, you know, get their comeuppance, and then say, oh, well, that's not really fair, you know. I mean,
oh, right, the other guy.
Exactly.
The name of the book is Panic 2012. It is an ebook. It's from BuzzFeed and Blue Rider Press. And however you get your ebooks, you can figure it out. Just put in Panic 2012 and you can find it. Michael Hastings, a great pleasure. This is an amazing piece of work, and I thank you very much for sharing with us this morning.
Thanks for the kind words, and appreciate you reading it. Really appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Again, Michael Hastings, Panic 2012. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.